Welcome back to the program. No matter how much we love our technology, it would be foolish to think that it has only positive effects on us. The impact on our lives has been so profound, our acceptance so overwhelming, that arguably, in some ways, it must rewire us to see the world differently. This is some of the background for my guest Mac Richtel's new thriller, The Cloud. Matt is a Pulitzer Prize-winning technology reporter for the New York Times. In addition to his work for the Times, he's the author of the previous bestseller, The Devil's Plaything. And it is my pleasure to welcome Matt Richtel back to this program to talk about The Cloud. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Talk a little bit about what got you started on this particular story and how in many ways it grew out of the work that you were reporting about the impact that technology is having on all of us.
Yeah, not to be too hyperbolic about it, but something is happening to our brains, and in particular, something is happening to our children's brains. And this is my third novel. I like to write fast-paced mystery thrillers. They let me explore, some of the theories I can't do in the New York Times. And I've got two little kids, and the combination of those things led me down a path that, for me at least, was really exhilarating, and I hope it will be for the thriller, for the reader, The Cloud. What is happening to our children's brains?
Talk a little bit about that, because on the one hand, we hear a lot about the impact of technology, the problem with video games, the impact of all the smartphones that are so much a part of our lives. But in fact, they really are having an effect on us. The cloud takes it one step further and into some potential future, but clearly the impact is real. We know that.
Yeah, I think we know that, and I think we're beginning to accept it. And those are two different things. When I say we know that, I think researchers are beginning to can prove to you that some things are happening. For instance, when you interact with your device, you get a little dopamine squirt, a little burst of adrenaline, and then in its absence, you might feel bored. They can prove to you that parts of your brain light up when you do certain technologies, that you're kind of hunting and gathering in a very primitive way, and you're stimulating really deep primitive impulses when you use your device. That we know. When I say we're beginning to accept, I hear people now in Silicon Valley, the very people making this stuff, saying, holy cow, this is more powerful than we thought. This is not just entertainment we're creating. This is a kind of neurological experience. So yes, I do believe we're coming to terms with it. Does that mean we're doing anything about it? Does that mean we should be doing anything about it? Those are different questions.
And are these things happening quickly? I mean, we know that evolution, for example, moves at a very, very slow pace. Should we be worried in our lifetime, in our children's lifetime, that in fact the impacts of this really are going to be profound?
Jeff, that's a great question. You're right. You're dead right about the use of the term evolution. I don't think our brains are changing, meaning the shape of them, the composition of them is changing in the way maybe it sounded earlier in this conversation. But, and this is a really big but, we understand about the brain in a way we didn't 20 or 30 years ago, that it's the word they use is plastic, that it is very adaptable and adaptive. And what researchers worry about is that in particular with children whose brains are plastic, still developing, that when they are on their devices all the time, to be very succinct about it, it could affect their long-term focus. And in this story, in this thriller, The Cloud, I explore a kind of conspiracy around that idea, and it begins with this, you know, very provocative, hopefully provocative, I shouldn't review my own work, provocative moment in which something happens with a little girl in Menlo Park, and an investigator has to go figure out exactly what that is.
One of the things that you explore and that we're seeing is that the line that exists that separates our brains from our technology, from the cloud, from where all of the information in our lives is stored, that membrane, that separation is becoming thinner and thinner and thinner.
Yeah, well said. You know, when I was a kid and my parents didn't want me to say watch TV, there was a TV and a screen in the living room and they could tell when I was watching it. The membrane is much thinner. If you want to monitor what your kids are doing, Well, how do you stop them from looking at the phone in their pocket, which is now the TV screen, which is now the phone, which is now the texting device? And, you know, just to really, you know, put a show how slim the membrane is getting, you know, these new Google glasses we're talking about, you don't even have to put in your pocket. The future is the stuff on your eyes that where the information strolls in front of you. You know, try doing that while taking your driver's test.
Have you thought about the impact that all of this has on you as you're sitting down to write about it?
Oh, so much. And in fact, really, you began the conversation by asking, where does the impulse to write about this stuff come from? It comes from, as a journalist, being, you know, duty bound and then kind of trained to watch how I interact with the world, because that's where a lot of stories come from. You gauge your reactions to things, and I've been watching my reactions to these things for 4 or 5 years, and I see the impact as extraordinary. I really sometimes struggle to put down my device. May I tell you a little amusing story around that?
Of course.
A few weeks ago, I've got a lot going on right now. You know, the New York Times. I've got the cloud coming out, which means book events and travel. I'm working on some nonfiction on these various subjects. I've been a little bit over the top. I try to live with some balance. So I go to this woman occasionally who I call the witch. She's a kind of a spiritual healer. You know, basically everyone in the Bay Area is a spiritual healer, and this is mine. And I go there for a massage and, you know, shiatsu massage and come down a little bit. She says, "You're pretty agitated, Matt. What's going on?" I go, I can't get away from this device. She goes, "I can help you with that." She takes the phone and she puts it under an owl's wing that she has among her tools and starts to do some chanting. I said, "My friend, what are you doing?" She's like, "This will help." So I don't know if you got an owl's wing. Give it a shot.
It's almost, not so much the owl, but almost anything that we can come up with that'll take that technology away from us for just a little bit of time is a positive step.
Yeah, I mean, that really was taking the you know, the strangeness out of it, and I actually think she's not strange at all. Her point was to create a sense of intention, to create an intention that you're separating yourself from this thing, and your listeners may be saying, well, you know, come on, do I really need to really separate myself from this thing? Do I need an intention to do this? Is this some new agey stuff? The reality is it really, really is not, Jeff. I mean, we haven't gotten into all the research to the demand, the value of downtime, but to the extent that you create downtime for your brain, you give it the ability to process in the background. And absent that, you're going to be less creative, less energetic, less probably valuable, less productive. Even in Silicon Valley, a number of these big companies are urging people to put down their device. And, you know, going back to the cloud, the more we see kids on this stuff, given how tender and vulnerable their brains are, I think the more we might see something really scary develop.
The other part of it is that maybe looking down the future, that putting down the device becomes not necessarily an option anymore, that we have to learn to accomplish all of those positive things that you're talking about within the context of technology itself, that somehow we have to find a way to use technology to fill in, to replace those things we're not getting because we have it with us in such an omnipresent way.
That's what the technology companies would want to tell you. They say, well, technology will be the answer to technology. At least that was the answer for a long time. But honestly, really, Jeff, I tell you, some places like Google and Facebook have people on their staffs who are coaching the very people making this stuff to disconnect on some regular basis. So I get where you're going with that. I'm not sure that that has worked out so far. I'm not sure that having technology as the answer to technology works. I do think there's a very positive thing here, a positive possibility here, which is to the extent that you can show discipline and have your kids show discipline, the technology can be insanely powerful and for the good. For instance, this morning I'm talking to you from my home office. There's a New York Times office downtown. Thanks to technology, I don't have to commute today. If I can use it for the good, I get to spend more time with my kids. I get to spend time talking about this book, which I'm really passionate about with you, and in a more cynical sense, to market a book, which is part of my job. That's all using it for the good. And if I do this well at lunch, I'll go play tennis rather than, you know, sit a cubicle and fiddle around on eBay. So, you know, that's the positive out of it.
Talk a little bit about the cloud and how you've woven some of these ideas that we've been talking about into this thriller without obviously giving away too much.
Well, the first thing is what I've tried to do, I think, is more important even than the technology, which I'm really excited about. And I think I don't want to give too much away, either in the kind of the science of it or the big ideas in it. But the thing I really like here is that there's a deep emotional core in this book. There's a character who's suffering some personal damage, who goes on a real journey to understand what's going on with him, and discover something super powerful about himself by the end of this book. And what I've tried to do is weave a story about his journey with the journey we're all going on, use his journey of personal growth as a metaphor for what our journey of personal growth might be. Now, if that sounds like a high wire act that I could fall off of, I hope I didn't. I hope it succeeded. I'm really, really gratified by the reviews that have come out so far. This is my third, and I think I've matured a lot. So hopefully I've woven them effectively, but I guess you guys will be the judge.
The Cloud, in addition to being a thriller, would you put it in the realm of science fiction in some ways? And if so, talk about the ways in which science fiction today, particularly if it deals with very real technology that we're struggling with, how maybe it's different from science fiction in the past.
Yeah, I like that. I like that question a lot because I think about it a lot. I think science fiction, once we thought of as this sort of distant, futuristic, almost social commentary, you know, about the world, what might rockets look like? I think science fiction's gotten a lot closer to home. One reason for that is technology's escalating so quickly that you can effectively write about something that 18 months that looks like it was wide-eyed and science fiction and comes true. So that's one thing, is that science fiction probably is getting, for some of us, wouldn't be called the science fiction of old, because we're writing about near-term stuff that at the same time is futuristic. Does that make sense?
Yes, except that at one point, I suppose, we all thought we were going to have jetpacks on our back and that our phones and everything else would be in our wrists, which may be happening, but not before too long. But a lot of the science fiction of old we thought was going to be technology that would happen that didn't really develop the way we thought it might.
That's true, but that is very, very, very true. Good point. The other way I look at science fiction is that science fiction tends to be, when it's at its best, it's really social commentary. It's really almost a kind of satire about the way we're living our lives. You know, the volume of our society turned up from where it is at 5 to 11. And that's what I've tried to do on this, is just take the dial up another turn or two, not to the point where it seems so far-fetched, but rather to the point where it seems like, hey, we might be one turn of the screw away from that. And in fact, a lot of the notes I get, both on The Cloud and then The Floodgate is a short story that's included in it, people say, you know, man, I'm starting to really reconsider my relationship with my device. Not the device of the future, the device of the present.
How does that alter generationally? In other words, when younger people read your work, when they read The Devil's Plaything or they might read The Cloud, how do they look at it differently, perhaps, than baby boomers might?
I had an audience of about 55 in Boulder, Colorado on Saturday night, and most of them were the boomers, and they like to shake their heads and say, what's wrong with those young people? And then about a couple 25-year-olds came up, and I asked them, you know, what we talked about this and gotten much more into the science and you know, what are their thoughts? And they said, they seem to say, we think that there is a very fine path that can be walked here. Yes, these ideas are provocative. Yes, you are causing us to rethink how we use our device, but no, we don't have any real intention of changing on a broad level. We're not really worried. This is the world we live in the very way that, say, you know, whatever the thing in the 50s or 60s or 70s or 80s that terrified the older generation, that the kid said, this is just the way it is, like rock and roll. With that in mind, can I just draw one distinction that I wrote about for the New York Times that I think is a very powerful
please.
One? You know, we had this idea as a society that if we close the digital divide, that we'd start to see some parity in learning among young people. And I don't know, do you remember the term the digital divide? Should I just highlight it really quickly?
Of course.
The digital divide was this idea that there were haves and have-nots with technology. The haves were wealthier and probably more educated. They could afford the computers and the phones, and the have-nots, and this is very broadly speaking, were the lower socioeconomic groups. Well, something really startling came to researchers in the last couple years, in the last year in particular. We began to close the digital divide, particularly through smartphones. So lower socioeconomic groups wind up with more technology. Rather than creating educational parity, when we close the digital divide, a number of key researchers believe that we have increased the time-wasting gap, that kids on the latchkey kids, maybe the kids who have whose parents have less time for supervision because they're working two jobs or they're single parents, or, you know, I'm way over generalizing here, but what you wind up with is when everybody has the devices, the kids whose parents have less time to monitor or coach will actually waste more time. So this goes to the idea about young people. Part of it is really comes down a huge way to parental responsibility, and you're going to see kids using it differently depending very much on the kind of coaching an example and mentorship set by the parents.
The other aspect, and Tom Friedman wrote about this yesterday in your newspaper, the way the digital divide or the lack of it around socioeconomic status has changed the international landscape and changed how people respond to things because everybody has this technology now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I look back at things. I mean, just to pick one example, but you know, would that people in Eastern Europe in the World War II have had this stuff and they could have let us know about the concentration camps? I mean, it's immense upside to that closing of the membrane across nation states and in communication. There's so many issues at play here. It's slightly different than what's happening to the brain, but I think ultimately not different at all, because what it shows is that top to bottom the world is changing. This stuff is changing us internally, playing to some deep needs and primitive instincts for good and ill, and then it's changing us all the way up to the nation state, the death of institutions, the challenges that big corporations face from all kinds of places. I mean, really, we're going to look back at this period as an infancy, and hopefully we wind up wielding this stuff for good and not ill.
In many ways, the changes to the brain are a kind of metaphor for the larger changes that are taking place in society, as you say, and that sort of relates to this whole idea of the cloud as well, that this is all interconnected in places that we can't even imagine.
Yeah, I wish I would have said that. That was the metaphor for what's happening inside our brains. You're right. The metaphor being it is playing to and helping us in these extraordinarily powerful ways. And again, you know, to the extent we use that wisely, it could be one of the greatest tools we've ever had as humans to get more intimate, more connected, to create more space in our lives, to be more productive. But it is so powerful, so powerful, that if we don't use it wisely, it could consume us. And I think of it a little bit the way I think about the immune system. The immune system is the great defender of our bodies. It is our savior. It is the man on the wall. And when it goes wrong with Crohn's or HIV or any of these diseases, it is so deadly. And I think that what's happening to us is we are experiencing kind of a technological version of the immune system. When we use this stuff well, it is so powerful. If we let it get the best of us, it can consume us. And that, for, you know, hopefully in an entertaining way, is what happens in the cloud, but maybe our protagonist will stop it from doing something terrible.
Matt Richtel, his new novel is The Cloud. Matt, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Jeff. Have a great day.